Welcome to Refreshing Reflections. I'm Sean Scott, and today I'm reading Chicken Soup for the Soul, Jack Canfield, Mark Victor Hansen, Hannock, and Melody McCarty. I begin with A Family for Freddy. I remember the first time I saw Freddy. He was standing in his playpen at the adoption agency where I work. He gave me a toothy grin. What a beautiful baby, I thought. His boarding mother gathered him into her arms. Will you be able to find a family for Freddy? Then I saw it. Freddy had been born without arms. He's so smart. He's only 10 months old, and already he walks and talks. She kissed him. Say book for Miss Blair. Freddy grinned at me and hid his head on his boarding mother's shoulder. Now, Freddy, don't act that way, she said. He's really very friendly, she added. Such a good, good boy. Freddy reminded me of my own son when he was that age. The same thick, dark curls. The same brown eyes. You won't forget him, Mrs. Blair. You will try. I won't forget. I went upstairs and got out of my latest copy of The Hard to Place List. Freddy is a 10-month-old, white, Protestant boy of English and French background. He has brown eyes, dark brown hair, and fair skin. Freddy was born without arms, but is otherwise in good health. His boarding mother feels he is of superior mentality, and he is already walking and saying a few words. Freddy is a warm, affectionate child who has been surrendered by his natural mother and is ready for adoption. He's ready, I thought. But who is ready for him? It was 10 o'clock on a lovely late summer morning, and the agency was full of couples. Couples having interviews, couples meeting babies, families being born. These couples nearly always have the same dream. They want a child as much like themselves as possible, as young as possible, and most important, a child with no problems. If he develops a problem after we get him, they say, that is a risk we'll take, just like any other parents. But to pick a baby who already has a problem, that's too much. And who can blame them? I wasn't alone in looking for parents for Freddy. Any of the caseworkers meeting a new couple started with a hope. Maybe they were there for Freddy. But summer slipped into fall, and Freddy was with us for his first birthday. Freddy is so big, said Freddy, laughing. So big. And then I found them. It started out as it always does. An impersonal record in my box, a new case, a new home study, two people who wanted a child. They were Frances and Edwin Pearson. She was 41, he was 45. She was a housewife, he was a truck driver. I went to see them. They lived in a tiny white frame house in a big yard full of sun and old trees. They greeted me together at the door, eager and scared to death. Mrs. Pearson produced steaming coffee and oven-warm cookies. They sat before me on the sofa, close together, holding hands. After a moment, Mrs. Pearson began, "Today is our wedding anniversary, 18 years. Good years," Mrs. Pearson looked at his wife. "Except..." "Yes," she said. "Except, always the except." She looked around the room. "It's too neat," she said, "you know." I thought of my own living room with my three children, teenagers now. "Yes," I said, "I know. Perhaps we're too old." I smiled. "You don't think so," I said. "We don't either." You always think it will be this month and then next month, Mr. Pearson said. Examinations, tests, all kinds of things, over and over. But nothing ever happened. You just go on hoping and hoping, and time keeps slipping by. We've tried to adopt before this, Mr. Pearson said. One agency told us our apartment was too small, so we got this house. Then another agency said I didn't make enough money. We had decided that was it. But this friend told us about you, and we decided to make one last try. I'm glad, I said. Mrs. Pearson glanced at her husband proudly. Can we choose at all? She asked. A boy for my husband. We'll try for a boy, I said. What kind of boy? Mrs. Pearson laughed. How many kinds are there? Just a boy. My husband is very athletic. He played football in high school, basketball too, and track. He would be good for a boy. Mr. Pearson looked at me. I know you can't tell exactly, he said, but can you give us any idea how soon? We've waited so long. I hesitated. There was always this question. Next summer, maybe, said Mrs. Pearson, we could take him to the beach. That long? Mr. Pearson said. Don't you have anyone at all? There must be a little boy somewhere. After a pause, he went on. Of course we can't give him as much as other people. We haven't a lot of money saved up. We've got a lot of love, his wife said. We've saved up a lot for that. Well, I said cautiously, there is a little boy. He is 13 months old. Oh, Mr. Pearson said, just a beautiful age. I have a picture of him, I said, reaching for my purse. I handed them Freddie's picture. He is a wonderful little boy, I said, but he was born without arms. They studied the picture in silence. He looked at her. What do you think, Fran? Kickball, Mrs. Pearson said. You could teach him kickball. Athletics are not so important, Mr. Pearson said. He can learn to use his head. Arms he can do without. A head, never. He can go to college. We'll save for it. A boy is a boy, Mrs. Pearson insisted. He needs to play. You can teach him. I'll teach him. Arms aren't everything. Maybe we can get him some. They have forgotten me. But maybe Mr. Pearson was right, I thought. Maybe sometime Freddie could be fitted with artificial arms. He did have nubs where arms should be. Then you might like to see him? They looked up. When could we have him? You think you might want him? Mrs. Pearson looked at me. Might, she said. Might? We want him, her husband said. Mrs. Pearson went back to the phone. You've been waiting for us, she said, haven't you? His name is Freddy, I said, but you can change it. No, said Mr. Pearson, Frederick Pearson. It's good together. And that was it. There were formalities, of course, and by the time we set the day, Christmas lights were strung across city streets, and wreaths were hung everywhere. I met the Pearsons in the waiting room. There was a little snow on them both. Your son's here already, I told them. Let's go upstairs and I'll bring him to you. I've got butterflies, Mrs. Pearson announced. Suppose he doesn't like us? I put my hand on her arm. I'll get him, I said. Freddie's boarding mother had dressed him in a new white suit, with a sprig of green holly and red berries embroidered on the collar. His hair shone a mop of dark curls. Going home, Freddie said to me, smiling as his boarding mother put him in my arms. I told him that, she said. I told him he was going to his new home. She kissed him, and her eyes were wet. Goodbye, dear. Be a good boy. boy. Good boy, said Freddy cheerfully. Going home. I carried him upstairs to the little room where the Pearsons were waiting. When I got there, I put him on his feet and opened the door. Merry Christmas, I said. Freddy stood uncertainly, rocking a little, gazing intently at the two people before him. They drank him in. Mr. Pearson knelt on one knee. Freddy, come here. Come to Daddy. Freddy looked back at me for a moment. Then turning, he walked slowly toward them, and they reached out their arms and gathered him in. Abby Blair. A Birthday Song. Three things in human life are important. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. And the third is to be kind. Henry James. One morning, John Evans shuffled into my life, a ragged-looking boy. He was decked out in oversized hand-me-down clothes and worn-out shoes that split apart at the seams. John was the son of a black migrant workers who had recently arrived in our small North Carolina town for a season of apple picking. These laborers were the poorest of the poor, earning barely enough to feed their families. Standing at the head of our second grade class that morning, John Evans was a hapless sight. He shifted from foot to foot as our teacher, Mrs. Parmalee, penned his name in the roll book. We weren't sure what to make of the shoddy newcomer, but whispers of disapproval began drifting from row to row. "What is that?" the boy behind me mumbled. "Somebody open a window," a girl said, giggling. Mrs. Parmalee looked up at us from behind her reading glasses. The murmuring stopped, and she went back to her paperwork. "Class, this is John Evans," Mrs. Parmalee announced, trying to sound enthusiastic. John looked around and smiled, hoping somebody would smile back. Nobody did. He kept on grinning anyway. I held my breath, hoping Mrs. Parmalee wouldn't notice the empty desk behind next to mine. She did and pointed him in that direction. He looked over at me as he slid into the seat, but I averted my eyes so he wouldn't think that I had promised to a new friend. By the end of his first week, John had found firm footing at the bottom of our school social ladder. "It's his own fault," I told my mother one evening at dinner. "He barely even knows how to count." My mother had grown to know John quite well through my nightly commentary. She always listened patiently, but rarely uttered more than a pensive, or "I see." "Can I sit by you?" John stood in front of me, lunch tray in hand and a grin on his face. I looked around to see who was watching. "Okay," I replied feebly. As I watched him eat and listened to him ramble on, it dawned on me that maybe some of the ridicule helped on John was unwarranted. He was actually pleasant to be around and was by far the most chipper boy I knew. After lunch, we joined forces to conquer the playground, moving from monkey bars to swing set to sandbox. As we lined up behind Mrs. Parmalee for the march back to class, I made up my mind that John would remain friendless no longer. "Why do you think the kids treat John so badly?" I asked one night as Mother tucked me into bed. "I don't know," she said sadly. "Maybe that's all they know." "Mom, tomorrow is his birthday, and he's not going to get anything. No cake, no presents, nothing. Nobody even cares." Mother and I both knew that whenever a kid had a birthday, his mother would bring cupcakes and party favors to the entire class. Between my birthday and my sister's, my mom had made several trips herself over the years. But John's mother worked all day in the orchards. His special day would go unnoticed. "Don't worry," Mom said as she kissed me goodnight. "I'm sure everything will turn out fine." For the first time in my life, I thought she might be wrong. At breakfast the next morning, I announced that I wasn't feeling well and wished to stay home. "Does this have anything to do with John's birthday?" Mother asked. The bright red flush on my cheeks was the only answer she needed. "How would you like it if your only friend didn't show up on your birthday?" she asked gently. I thought it over for a moment and then kissed her goodbye. I wished John a happy birthday first thing in the morning, and his embarrassed smile showed me that he was glad I had remembered. Maybe it wouldn't be such a horrible day after all. By mid-afternoon, I had almost decided that birthdays weren't that big a deal. Then, as Mrs. Parmalee was writing math questions on the blackboard, I heard a familiar sound coming from the hallway. A voice I knew was singing the birthday song. Moments later, Mother came through the door with a tray of cupcakes aglow with candles. Tucked under her arm was a smartly wrapped present with a red bow on top. Mrs. Parmalee's high-pitched voice joined in while the class stared at me for an explanation. Mother found John looking like a deer caught in car headlights. She put the cupcakes and gift on his desk and said, "Happy birthday, John." My friend graciously shared his cupcakes with the class, patiently taking the tray from desk to desk. I caught Mother watching me. She smiled and winked as I bit into moist chocolate frosting. Looking back, I can scarcely remember the names of the children who shared that birthday. John Evans moved on shortly thereafter, and I never heard from him again. But whenever I hear that familiar song, I remember the day its notes rang most true. In the soft tones of my mother's voice, the glint in a boy's eyes, and the taste of the sweetest cupcake. Robert Tate Miller. When Kevin won. Maturity begins to grow when you can sense your concern for others outweighing your concern for yourself. John McNaughton. If you had to choose one word to describe Kevin, it might have been slow. He didn't learn his ABCs as fast as other kids. He never came in first in the schoolyard races. However, Kevin had a special rapport with people. His smile was brighter than the sun in June, his heart bigger than the mountain sky. Kevin's enthusiasm for life was quite contagious, so when he discovered that the pastor at his church, Randy, was putting together a boys' basketball team, his mother could only answer, "Yes, you may join." Basketball became the center of Kevin's life. At practice, he worked so hard you'd have thought he was preparing for the NBA. He liked to stand in a certain spot near the free throw line and shoot baskets. Patiently, he stood there throwing ball after ball after ball, until finally it would swish through the hoop. "Look at me, coach," he'd yell at Randy, jumping up and down, his face just glowing with the thrill of it all. The day before their first game, Coach Randy gave each player a bright red jersey. Kevin's eyes absolutely turned to stars when he saw his number 12. He scrambled himself into the sleeves and scarcely ever took it off again. One Sunday morning, the sermon was interrupted by Kevin's excited voice. "Look, Coach!" He lifted his gray wool sweater to reveal his beautiful red jersey to God and everyone. Kevin and his whole team truly loved basketball. But just loving the game doesn't help you win. More balls fell out of the basket than into it, and the boys lost every game that season by very large margins, except one. The night it snowed and the other team couldn't make it to the game. At the end of the season, the boys played in the church league's tournament. As the last-place team, they drew the unfortunate spot of playing against the first-place team. the tall, undefeated first place team. The game went pretty much as expected, and near the middle of the fourth quarter, Kevin's team stood nearly 30 points behind. At that point, one of Kevin's teammates called timeout. As he came to the side, Randy couldn't imagine why the timeout had been called. "Coach," said the boy, "this is our last game, and I know that Kevin has played in every game, but he's never made a basket. I think we should let Kevin make a basket." With the game completely out of reach, the idea seemed reasonable, so plans were made. Every time Kevin's team had the ball, Kevin was to stand in his special spot near the free throw line, and they would give him the ball. Kevin skipped extra high as he went back onto the court. His first shot bounced around but missed. Number 17 from the other team swiped the ball and took it down to the other end, scoring 2 more points. As soon as Kevin's team had the ball again, they passed it to Kevin, who obediently stood in his place, but he missed again. This pattern continued a few more times until number 17 grew wise. He grabbed one of the rebounds, and instead of running off down the court, he threw the ball to Kevin, who shot and missed again. Soon all the players were circling Kevin, throwing the ball to him and clapping for him. It took the spectators just a little longer to figure out what was happening, but little by little people started to stand up and clap their hands. The whole gymnasium thundered with the clapping, hollering, chanting, "Kevin, Kevin," and Kevin just kept shooting. Coach Randy realized the game must be over. He looked up at the clock, which was frozen with 46 seconds left. The referee stood by scoring table, cheering and clapping like everyone else. The whole world was stopped, waiting and wanting for Kevin. Finally, after an infinite amount of tries, the ball took one miraculous bounce and went in. Kevin's arm shot high into the air and he shouted, "I won! I won!" The clock ticked off the last few seconds, and the first place team remained undefeated. But on that evening, everyone left the game truly feeling like a winner. Janice M. Gibson, as told to her by Reverend Steve Gaudier. Beautiful on the inside. Lisa, my 2-year-old daughter, and I were walking down the street and toward home one sunny morning when two elderly women stopped in front of us. Smiling down at Lisa, one of them said, "Do you know you are a very beautiful little girl?" Sighing and putting her hand on her hip, Lisa replied in a bored voice, "Yes, I know." A bit embarrassed by my daughter's seeming conceit, I apologized to the two ladies and we continued our walk home. All the way there, I was trying to determine how I was going to handle this situation. After we went into the house, I sat down and stood Lisa in front of me. I gently said, "Lisa, when those two ladies spoke to you, they were talking about how pretty you are on the outside. It's true. You are pretty on the outside. That's how God made you. But a person needs to be beautiful on the inside, too." As she looked at me uncomprehendingly, I continued, "Do you want to know how a person is beautiful on the inside?" She nodded solemnly. "Okay. Being beautiful on the inside is a choice you make, honey. To be good to your parents, a good sister to your brother, and a good friend to the children you play with. You have to care about other people, honey. You have to share your toys with your playmates. You need to be caring and loving when someone is in trouble or gets hurt and needs a friend. When you do all those things, you are beautiful on the inside. Do you understand what I'm saying?" "Yes, Mommy. I'm sorry I didn't know that," she replied. Hugging her, I told her I loved her and that I didn't want her to forget what I'd said. The subject never came up again. Nearly 2 years later, we moved from the city to the country and enrolled Lisa in a preschool program. In her class was a little girl named Jenna, whose mother had died. The child's father had recently married a woman who was energetic, warm, and spontaneous. It was readily apparent that she and Jenna had a wonderful, loving relationship. One day, Lisa asked if Jenna could come over to play for an afternoon, so I made arrangements with her stepmother to take Jenna home with us the next day after the morning session. As we were leaving the parking lot the following day, Jenna said, "Can we go see my mommy?" I knew her stepmother was working, so I said cheerfully, "Sure. Do you know how to get there?" Jenna said she did, and following her directions, I soon found myself driving up the gravel road into the cemetery. My first response was one of alarm as I thought of the possible negative reaction of Jenna's parents when they learned what had happened. However, it was obvious that visiting her mother's grave was very important to her, something she needed to do, and she was trusting me to take her there. Refusing would send her message that it was wrong of her to want to go there. Outwardly calm, as though I'd known this was where we were going all along, I asked Jenna, "Do you know where your mother's grave is?" "I know about where it is," she responded. I parked on the road in the area she indicated, and we looked around until I found a grave with her mother's name on a small marker. The two little girls sat down on one side of the grave, and I sat on the other, and Jenna started talking about how things had been at home in the months leading up to her mother's death, as well as what had happened on the day she died. She spoke for some time, and all the while, Lisa, with tears streaming down her face, had her arms around Jenna, and patting her gently, said quietly over and over, "Oh, Jenna, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry your mother died." Finally, Jenna looked at me and said, "You know, I still love my mommy, and I love my new mommy, too." Pamela J. DeRoy. Well, we are out of time, but I would like to leave you with a quote by Pamela J. DeRoy. "Love is a wonderful thing. You never have to take it away from one person to give it to another. There's always more than enough to go around." Thank you for listening. I'm Sean Scott. And until next time, may we all be refreshed.